Hello and welcome to the IEA podcast with me, Emma Revel, on Tuesday the 7th of April 2020. Don't forget, you can subscribe to all of our podcasts on Apple, Spotify or Podbean, where you can check out our extensive back catalogue, or subscribe to the IEA daily newsletter to never miss an episode. For millions of Britons, coronavirus has meant staying home. Even those who find it necessary to travel are limiting their journeys, avoiding public transport where possible, and staying close to home or work. Long-distance journeys by plane or train are almost impossible, with many companies running skeleton services or no services at all. It's natural to hope things will return to normal when the pandemic restrictions are lifted, but will that really be the case? The AA has suggested there could be a permanent reduction in the demand for travel because people have learned during this crisis to use home working technology. If the lockdown shows us we can live without the daily commute, what does that mean for our future transport infrastructure? As well as a possible fall in commuter travel, anxiety around coronavirus may linger for longer than the actual disease, with people reluctant to pile onto crowded trains or tube carriages for long after the immediate danger of infection has passed. How would a fall in passenger numbers affect businesses and government revenue, and what, if anything, should we be doing about it? Joining me to discuss this today is Dr. Richard Wellings, Head of Transport at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Emma.
As I mentioned in the introduction, the AA has suggested that one outcome from the restrictions we're all currently living under could be a permanent reduction in demand for travel as people realise how easily they can work from home. However, former Transport Secretary Andrew Adonis has been a lot more sceptical, arguing it's too early to say. What do you think?
Well, obviously, once the lockdown is over with, I think a lot of people, they're going to have cabin fever. They're going to be desperate to get out and about in the short term. But looking beyond that into the longer term, I think obviously a lot of businesses and a lot of individuals, they've now invested in the software to do things like web conferencing. They've invested in the training time, the effort to learn how to use these apps, etc. And we've seen some of the data on the downloads of some of these web conferencing apps, and they're absolutely astounding in their magnitude. So huge numbers of people have finally got to grips with this technology. I think looking forward, obviously keeping office space is expensive, commuting is expensive, traveling say down to London for a meeting from Manchester or Leeds is very expensive. So obviously there are big incentives to move at least some meetings to online technology, and probably more and more people will be working from home, say 1 or 2 days a week as well, just because it saves such a huge amount of money.
Exactly. I mean, once people have invested in things, I mean, we're having this conversation now over video technology, millions of other people will be doing the same thing. So I mean, once people, businesses have invested in this, there's an incentive to keep that going, right?
Exactly. And I think people start to realise that it really does work pretty well in most circumstances. So maybe, you know, we won't be able to replace all, say, face-to-face meetings. But, I mean, this trend was already happening. So more and more things were being done online. For example, some tribunals were being held with evidence given by video, for example. So lawyers would no longer have to travel to the other end of the country by train. So I think this will start to change everything. And even Transport for London over the last 2 or 3 years has been picking up a stagnation in commuter traffic, which I think they think is probably caused by more and more people working from home 1 or 2 days a week. So it's starting to affect the finances of these big transport bureaucracies already.
I mean, as you say, this is already an existing trend that's been observed. I found a great statistic that was something I was reading the other day that said that following tube strikes, I think 5% of people stuck to the route that they took while the strike was going on. So actually people are finding, even the people who are still travelling, are finding more efficient ways to travel or ways that work better for them.
That's true, but I mean, there's a big caveat here, of course. Obviously, for example, as the recent IEA paper showed, obviously not all sectors can equally work from home, for example, so not all workers find it so easy. So particularly, you know, the professional and business types often find it quite easy to work from home, but obviously there are many other sectors and types of jobs where it's not quite so easy to either work from home or have meetings online.
Well, exactly. So I mean, this is going to impact different modes of transport in different ways. The AA also suggested that if there is a fall in demand, things like the £27 billion the government currently has earmarked on ways to curb congestion on roads won't be needed and could actually be spent better on other ways to level up the country, like faster broadband, for example. Do you think that would be a better use of taxpayers' money?
Well, I think really the devil's in the detail here, and it depends on the costs and benefits of every specific infrastructure scheme. So, for example, some of the road infrastructure in the pipeline is very much targeted towards freight traffic, and I don't think that's going to be particularly affected by this new technology, at least in the medium term. And also, obviously, you know, really, I think the ones that will suffer are those schemes that rely very heavily on business travellers, who obviously have the much stronger incentives to move to this kind of web conferencing and so on, because obviously the cost of them in terms of time is so enormous from having to travel when there's probably no need.
So, I mean, this is going to affect people who travel perhaps briefly in short journeys or the sort of rare long journey for a meeting, but people who use quite intensive travel day to day, you think they're probably not going to be shifting their pattern so much?
Well, even with them, in certain sectors, I think more of them will decide to work, say, one day a week from home, because maybe they found it's more productive for certain kinds of tasks. For example, they're not constantly being interrupted in the office if they have to do something that involves more concentration. Obviously, not every task is going to be like that, but maybe if they can divide the tasks up and do those at home that are more efficient done from home and those in the office that are more efficient done from the office. And you might see more sort of hot desking and that kind of things, where people only go into, say, central London or the big city once a week when they really need to, and the rest of the time they're working from home and using this new technology.
Okay, people organising their diaries more productively, leading to a reduction in transport. Regular listeners to this podcast and fans of the IEA will know, Richard, that you've been a long-time HS2 sceptic. So back in 2013, you wrote a report that predicted the eventual cost of the project could rise to over £80 billion at a time when the official budget had already crept from the low 30s to around £50 billion. We're now looking at a cost much closer to £100 billion. If we're travelling less after this pandemic, surely the case for HS2 is even weaker than it was before.
I think that's right. And as we're talking earlier about how it would affect different sectors differently, and the problem that HS2 has is that its economic case is very heavily reliant on time savings for business travellers. So obviously the value of their time is very high because they tend to get paid a lot. And it's very heavily reliant on them. And these are exactly the people who have very large incentives to shift to things like video conferencing, web conferencing, and also working from home. So when you've already got a business case that's very, very weak, basically it's touch and go whether the costs will actually outweigh the benefits even now. But when you add this new technology in and then this permanent shift we're going to get from the pandemic, I think really HS2 is in even more trouble now.
I mean, as the AA, you know, they suggested something like faster broadband as a better way to level up the country. Because when people talk about levelling up the country, one of the main things that they do focus on is the difficulty getting to places that aren't major cities like London and Manchester. Do you think faster broadband infrastructure would have more of an impact than faster trains, for example?
It may well do, but I do have concerns about the government getting involved in this and starting to subsidise these projects. And I think really it's less of a north-south divide than an urban-rural divide, as I understand it, with certain areas having quite slow broadband in more remote places. Having said that, the danger is that the government would end up picking the wrong technology that's then superseded a few years later, or would inefficiently subsidise particular locations just because they have a loud voice, so they get lobbied very hard to support a particular town, for example, or a particular village, when it might not be the best use of resources. So the danger is we'll see the kind of project disasters we've seen in normal conventional transport infrastructure.
Just replicated in the digital realm, I understand.
Yeah.
Changes to our travel habits, whether they're temporary or whether they're permanent, they're going to have a significant impact both on the government revenue from things like petrol duty, for example, and the financial health of travel companies. So, I mean, in response to the coronavirus, the government have effectively nationalised passenger rail travel and suspended franchises for 6 months, and airlines are hovering around the Chancellor in hopes of a bailout or other financial support. In normal times, free marketeers like you and me would say that if a company fails to adapt to customer demand and goes bust, that's the market functioning properly. That's what's supposed to happen. Do the unusual circumstances we now find ourselves in make the more unusual steps justifiable?
I don't think so. And it's very tempting to try and do these bailouts to try and moderate the scale of the collapse at the moment. But the danger is, of course, that basically, in some of these areas, particularly, say, transport and tourism, we may be looking at longer term changes in behaviour. For example, some countries might start adopting much heavier restrictions on travellers coming into their country, which could have a negative effect on tourism and therefore on the airlines. So if we are going to get these longer term changes in behaviour, then the problem is the government could end up propping up lame ducks that would have gone under the market process. And by doing that, they create these zombie businesses that consume resources that need to be redeployed to better uses. And in this way, you actually hinder the economic recovery and lead to large-scale maladjustments in the economy. So there is a danger here that by trying to do this, the government will actually make things worse in the medium to long term.
So do you think there's anything that government could or should be doing to support, for example, with rail franchises? Do you know, that basically leaves only freight as the only real part of the rail network that has any private involvement, at least for the next 6 months. Do you think the government will be tempted to hang on to these nationalised franchises? Do you think they'll put them back, ideally, more open franchises with more competition? How do you see the future of Britain's railways looking after this?
Well, I mean, the problem was, I mean, we'd already seen the partial nationalisation, both through the creation of Network Rail back in 2002, 2003, and also through more and more government control over the train operators and the franchises. So effectively, the train operators were already subcontractors for the government, which I think is going to be the model going forward. The big question mark is whether this really helps cost control on the railways, or whether you get some gains, compensating gains in terms of a more efficient structure and more coordination between the track owners and the train operators. It's a difficult question to determine, but of course the government's deciding this and not letting the market do it, which is cause for concern. But the fundamental problem is that basically nearly all the rail routes are loss making, so the government's going to have to subsidise them to keep them going, which means inevitably there's going to be some kind of political meddling, which means a big bill for taxpayers, as we've seen.
I think there's very little part of the coronavirus recovery that's not going to involve a big bill for taxpayers. Any final thoughts on how coronavirus could impact our travel infrastructure, whether that's rail or planes?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with the last comment, because, of course, the public finances were already looking pretty shaky before the crisis hit, with slow growth as well. And obviously, the financial crisis hasn't really been resolved, with a lot of zombie companies, huge debts, etc. So the problem here is that the public finances are going to get even shakier still. And that could mean transport investment by the government being rapidly cut in, say, 2, 3, 4 years' time, just because there really isn't any money available for it. And obviously, it's politically more convenient than, say, cutting the NHS or welfare benefits.
I mean, personally, I'm in the category that can't wait for these restrictions to be over. I intend to hop on as many planes and trains as I can once this is done, but it remains to be seen what the rest of the country are going to do. If you want to find out more about the issues discussed in this episode, you can visit the IEA website, where you can find reports by Richard and others on HS2 road pricing and improving Britain's railways. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the IEA podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to them. While you're there, you can also check out our back catalogue with almost 150 episodes to help you pass the time.